acolyte or like a fan. You know, as I've said before, I've been to a number of U.S. states. They almost all have good things and things that are not so good. It can't be denied that California's economy is one of the most dynamic in the world. If California were a country, it would be one of the most powerful economies by itself in the world. The amount of innovation, the number of Nobel laureates, the amount of groundbreaking research in tech and medicine that is coming out of California. It's not coming out of, I'm not going to, you know, put any particular state on blast, but it's not coming out of a lot of other states. California operating with a budget surplus. It is expensive in California. That's because of that free market that right wingers love. California's state income tax is progressive and it goes all the way up to 13%. If you pay 37% federally and 13% in California, that's 50%. And then you add property taxes and properties are expensive in California. I'm not denying it's expensive. Part of the reason it's expensive is because there's not enough housing. Part of the reason it's expensive is because a lot of people want to live there. Homelessness, it's a major problem. Part of the reason that homelessness is a problem in California is the weather is good and it's a safe place if you have no home, that if you're stuck outside, you're not going to freeze to death. And I don't think just about any part of California, you could go up in the hills to ski resorts. I don't think that's where the homeless people are. So there are criticisms of California, but this idea that there is a California exodus because of woke high tax California and it's failing and all these different things, it is simply not the case. I've never lived in California. I don't intend to. I have no personal horse in this race, but that is the reality. We have a fantastic bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com. I want to see you there, and we will be back with a new program.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
CT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT in sound from way out.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Over the last 10 years, we've never seen such a high number of reported attacks on the health system as in 2022. The scale of it is just unimaginable.
Sudan's healthcare system is on the verge of collapse 2 months after fighting broke out between rival military factions. We'll look at the increasing targeting of hospitals from Sudan to Ukraine to Burma. Then, as Russia transfers tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus, we speak to Professor Jaber Ashkar, author of The New Cold War, The United States, Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine. Then to South Africa to talk to Kumi Naidu, the former head of Greenpeace and Amnesty. On Tuesday, he was forcibly removed from a shareholder meeting of a major bank financing, ECOP, that's the East African Crude Oil Pipeline.
What do we want? Justice. What do we want? What do we want? What do we want?
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Sudan, a regional governor from Darfur was assassinated Wednesday after he publicly blamed the paramilitary rapid support forces and allied Arab militias for the genocide of civilians. West Darfur state governor Khamis Abakhar was abducted and killed hours after making the remarks in a TV interview. Reuters reports two government sources said the RSF was responsible for the killing. On Wednesday, the International Organization for Migration said fighting between rival military factions in Sudan has now displaced more than 2 million people from their homes, with more than 500,000 fleeing to neighboring countries. Nearly 1,000 civilians have been killed, according to a local monitoring group. In Ukraine, the mayor of Kryvyi Rih says Russian missiles struck two civilian industrial sites overnight, injuring at least one person. The attack came days after another attack on the central Ukrainian city killed 11 civilians. Elsewhere, Ukraine's military said it shot down 18 Russian drones over the Black City port, city of Odessa, overnight. And Russia's TASS news agency reports Ukrainian artillery fire killed a child in a Russian-occupied part of Kherson region. On Tuesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin met with pro-war bloggers at the Kremlin, where he said Russia's military operations in Ukraine have been plagued by shortages of precision-guided munitions, communications gear, aircraft and drones, as well as other equipment, in a rare admission. The leader of Belarus said Tuesday he's received nuclear weapons from Russia and won't hesitate to use them if his nation's security is at stake. President Alexander Lukashenko made the remarks in an interview with a Russian state TV channel Tuesday evening.
We have missiles and bombs that we have received from Russia, both that are three times more powerful than the ones used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There, more than 80,000 people died instantly, 250,000 overall. That's from one strike. And this one is three times more powerful. I don't know, up to 1 million people would die immediately if, God forbid, this weapon were used.
Exiled Belarusian opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya called on the world leaders to respond to Russia's first deployment of tactical nuclear weapons outside its borders since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. She wrote on social media, quote, "It creates a serious threat to regional security and sets us on a dangerous path for nuclear escalation. The world must show Lukashenko and Putin that it won't give in to nuclear blackmail." Thousands of protesters took to the streets of cities across Poland Wednesday after a pregnant woman died when medical workers refused to provide her with a life-saving abortion. 33-year-old Dorota Lalik died of sepsis in May, 3 days after her water broke and she was admitted to the John Paul II Hospital. The hospital has deep ties to the Catholic Church, and medical staff there opted out of providing abortion care, citing a so-called conscience clause allowed under Polish law. This is a protester at Wednesday's pro-choice march in Warsaw.
I came here because I do not agree with women dying, that they have no choice, that doctors have a so-called conscience clause. If they want conscience clauses, they would change their profession. Women are dying because of them and also because of the law that has been established in Poland.
Here in the United States, the Justice Department has charged an active duty Marine and one other person for firebombing a Planned Parenthood clinic in Costa Mesa, California, with a Molotov cocktail in March of last year. The two arrested men, Chance Brannon and Tibet Irigul, could face up to 20 years in federal prison. In related news, a new report from the Center for Countering Digital Hate finds Google made over $10 million from ads by anti-abortion groups. The Google ads were for so-called crisis pregnancy centers, which aim to steer people away from having abortions while posing as reproductive health care clinics. The Southern Baptist Convention has voted to uphold the expulsion of two churches led by women pastors, tightening the church's restrictions on women, banning them not just from serving as pastors, but from having any kind of leadership position. The moves come after organizing by the Southern Baptist Church's ultra-conservative members. In climate news, officials in India and Pakistan have ordered the evacuation of more than 150,000 people as Cyclone Biparjoy makes landfall in India's Gujarat state. The storm crashed ashore earlier today near high tide with a storm surge that threatened to inundate low-lying coastal areas. It's just the third cyclone to hit India's west coast in nearly six decades. Here in the United States, thick smoke from dozens of wildfires burning in Canada settled over Wisconsin and Minnesota Wednesday, triggering air quality alerts for very unhealthy levels of fine particle and ozone pollution. The air quality index topped 240 in the Twin Cities, the region's worst levels on record. President Biden's vetoed legislation that would have rolled back a new rule limiting emissions from heavy-duty vehicles. The White House says the rule change will cut nitrogen oxide emissions in half by 2045, preventing thousands of childhood asthma cases and premature deaths every year. The bill to repeal the tougher emissions cleared the Senate in April with the support of Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and with ALN California Senator Dianne Feinstein absent. Meanwhile, the House of Representatives has failed in its effort to override President Biden's veto of legislation that would have blocked police accountability legislation passed by the Washington, D.C. City Council in the wake of George Floyd's murder. 13 Democrats joined with House Republicans in voting to overrule the D.C. law, which expands access to police disciplinary records and body camera footage, limits the use of tear gas and other chemical agents, and bans certain police tactics, including chokeholds. Washington, D.C.'s non-voting delegate to Congress, Eleanor Holmes Norton, said in a statement, quote, "The disapproval resolution is a profoundly undemocratic and paternalistic piece of legislation. Almost 700,000 people live in the nation's capital, and they're worthy and capable of governing their own local affairs," unquote. Here in New York, a grand jury has indicted former U.S. Marine Daniel Penny over the killing of Jordan Neely on a city subway on May 1st. Penny, who's white, held Jordan Neely in a chokehold until he died. Neely, a beloved street performer, was unhoused and hungry, crying out for help when the ex-Marine attacked him. The charges will be unsealed when Penny's arraigned. The date of his arraignment is expected to be announced today. The Federal Reserve has decided to hold interest rates steady after 10 consecutive increases since early 2022. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren welcomed Wednesday's announcement by Fed Chair Jerome Powell, writing, quote, "The Fed raised interest rates at the fastest pace in decades, and it needs to maintain this pause or risk throwing millions of Americans out of work," unquote. The European Union's advanced a major new law that would regulate artificial intelligence as governments around the world grapple with how to respond to the possible threats of the fast-moving technology. The EU draft law includes restrictions on the use of facial recognition and mandates disclosures of data by makers of chatbots and deepfake videos. This is European Parliament President Roberta Metsola.
Going forward, we are going to need constant, clear boundaries and limits to artificial intelligence. And here there is one thing that we will not compromise on. Anytime technology advances, it must go hand in hand with our fundamental rights and democratic values.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres recently said he supports the idea of global watchdog for artificial intelligence that could play a role in similar to how the International Agency of Atomic Energy regulates nuclear technology.
The scientists and experts have called on the world to act, declaring AI an existential threat to humanity on a par with the risk of nuclear war.
Here in the United States, Jennifer DiStefano, an Arizona mother, testified at a Senate hearing this week about her harrowing experience with a deep fake scam that tricked her into thinking her daughter had been kidnapped. DiStefano says the fake kidnappers demanded a $50,000 ransom before she got in touch with her daughter, who was in fact safe and sound.
It was my daughter's voice. It was her cries. It was her sobs. It was the way she spoke. I will never be able to shake that voice and the desperate cries for help out of my mind. It's every parent's worst nightmare to hear your child pleading with fear and pain, knowing that they are being harmed and that you're helpless. The longer this form of terror remains unpunishable, the farther and more egregious it will become. There is no limit to the depth of evil AI can enable.
Meanwhile, election integrity groups have been sounding the alarm over the use of AI to misinform people ahead of the 2024 U.S. election. Florida's Republican governor, presidential hopeful Ron DeSantis, released an attack ad earlier this month showing AI-generated deepfake images of Donald Trump hugging and kissing Anthony Fauci. And a Guatemalan court Wednesday convicted prominent journalist Jose Ruben Zamora of money laundering and sentenced him to 6 years in prison, what rights groups have condemned as a trumped-up case and part of a crackdown on press freedom by the right-wing government of President Alejandro Giammattei. Zamora is the founder and president of the investigative newspaper El Periódico and has long reported on Guatemalan government corruption. The newspaper was forced to shut down in May after months of intensifying harassment and persecution. To see our interview with José Rubén Zamora's son, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show with a humanitarian crisis unfolding in Sudan as the healthcare system there is collapsing after 2 months of fighting across Sudan between the army and the rapid support forces. Volunteers and aid workers are struggling to keep critical healthcare running. But the Sudan Doctors Trade Union says less than a third of hospitals in Sudan's conflict zones are still open. Many have been targeted by fighters. Those that continue to operate face cuts to power and water and a lack of staff, medicine, and dialysis supplies. Reports also show since the outbreak of the conflict in April, rape survivors are struggling to access emergency contraception and abortion medication because a warehouse with nearly 50,000 post-rape medical kits has been cut off. This comes as a new report from the Safeguarding Health and Conflict Coalition concluded 2022 was the worst year for attacks against healthcare facilities and personnel worldwide in the last decade. The report found a 45% increase in reported incidents of violence against or obstruction of healthcare in conflict zones as compared to 2021, including in Sudan. Over half the documented attacks were in two countries, Ukraine and Burma. For more, we're joined in Geneva by Christina Villa, director of Insecurity Insight, which contributed to the new report, Ignoring Red Lines, Violence Against Healthcare and Conflict. And we begin in Houston with Dr. Kadir Dalouk, advocacy director of the Sudanese American Physicians Association, which is providing support to Sudan's healthcare facilities and services during the crisis. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!, but we begin with the Sudanese doctor. Dr. Dulouk, can you talk about the situation in Sudan today? Today marks the 2 months where these rival military forces have been attacking each other. Of course, the collateral damage, as they say, the horror, is the number of civilians who have died or are also at this point seeking health care in places where that many hospitals don't even exist anymore.
Good morning to you, to Christina, and to your audience and viewers. As you report and you correctly mentioned, what is happening in Sudan is a calamity. It's almost a nightmare that is getting worse every day. And our concern, if this continues and the conflict, you know, spreads to neighboring states, this might break into civil war pretty soon. What is happening in Darfur is a total disaster, especially in El Geneina, where hospitals are completely shut down and civilians are, you know, between death and, you know, caught into, you know, the armed conflict. They're not even able to flee to neighboring Chad. As you mentioned in Khartoum, two-thirds of the hospitals are out of service, evacuated or forced to, you know, to close. My colleagues who are working on the ground, they're working in very difficult situations. It's not even comprehensible. They're working with very little, if no, supplies. The major concern we have is their safety. You know, healthcare professionals and providers are, you know, facing gunfire every day to reach to work and to their houses. They're completely burned out. They're not able to provide to their families because they have not had any salaries for months now. So it's not comprehensible the way they're working. And their safety is our biggest concern. They have been deliberately targeted since the conflict. Hospitals have been targeted. Almost 21 of our healthcare colleagues have lost their lives. A few days ago, one of our colleagues, he's a neurosurgeon. He lost his life while he was on duty serving in a hospital called Best Hospital in Khartoum. We as physicians have sworn an oath to treat and take care of civilians and military, whether it's in peace or it's in war. Me and my colleagues on the ground, they are doing their best to abide to this oath. Maybe the generals and those who are fighting have forgotten, you know, their oaths to defend the country and to defend civilians. And this is a reminder and a call to them that they should at least leave us do our duty.
And Dr. Dulouk, if you could speak specifically about what we mentioned in our introduction, namely the difficulties for women in accessing emergency abortion and reproductive rights medicine, because these rape kits, post-rape kits, tens of thousands of them are inaccessible. And this is in a moment in this conflict where there have been widespread reports of sexual violence and rape. And of course, in Sudan, abortion is illegal.
Well, it's very unfortunate that, you know, violence against women and rape is used as a weapon in this war. And this is not new. This has been, you know, the case in Darfur and the genocide that happened and the attacks back going back to 2000. So it's very unfortunate. You know, we are totally against, rape. And using, you know, women's body in this war. I think, there are no supplies, period, to any civilians, including women, including children. For the last 2 months, there are, you know, infants who have been born, and there are totally no vaccinations. And we are going to see an emergence of infectious diseases that have almost, you know, have been eradicated. That they're going to emerge because there are no vaccinations that are happening to those children. And as you correctly said, there are no kits to provide to those rape victims. It's very unfortunate. We're, you know, the internally displaced is another group of people who are facing a lot of, problems. We are trying to support four different hospitals in Madani, which is a neighboring state. We are, as Sudanese American Physician Association, operating or funding the operation of the hospital of a hospital in Halfa, and as well in Niala, as well in Niala Hospital. But unfortunately, because of the blockage of the borders in Egypt, as well as in Ethiopia, as well as other countries are closing up their visa access to Sudanese. There is a lot of people who are in the borders. Halfa Hospital, for example, is facing a huge number of patients that are people dying because, we're not able to operate like a government. We are an organization. We are doing our best, but this is not enough. I think if we don't act...
Look, let me ask you something. Do you think the military forces are targeting hospitals and other healthcare facilities? You've stated that so far 11 ambulances have been attacked by strikes, that the rapid force sources have commandeered ambulances, cars from the Ministry of Health. The significance of this as we begin to wrap up?
Well, as I said, hospitals and healthcare professionals have been deliberately targeted, and it's very unfortunate that, hospitals are used in this war, as areas where the conflict is going. These two generals are not abiding to any international law, not to any Geneva conventions, and I think what is important is safety of my colleagues on the ground. The impartiality of hospitals. Both parties are trying to force, healthcare professionals to, say that we are siding with this party or that party. This is not what we do. Our oath is to all civilians, and at times of war, this is not what we do. Our oath is towards those civilians and towards those who are injured, and this is what we do, and we want to abide to that. Me and my colleagues call for the international community to act now, not even tomorrow. They have to do it now.
I'd like to bring in Christina Villa into the conversation. If you could talk about what's happening in Sudan in the context of the report that your organization has put out, Ignoring Red Lines, Violence Against Healthcare in Conflict. Talk about what this report concludes.
Yeah, thanks so much. And most of all, thank you for putting this really important topic of violence against healthcare for discussion into your show, because it is always terrible when political conflict turns violent. And we've seen that in Sudan in past years during demonstrations and particularly now. But it is heartbreaking to see the personal consequences for people when they can't access healthcare in such situations. And I think you've already evoked several of these issues. Imagine a woman going into labor or needing emergency care after experiencing sexual violence, and then you have security forces using roadblocks to prevent access, and people seeking treatment when the hospitals are bombed or occupied and raided by security forces. And we've documented it numerous times for Sudan of military security forces going into hospitals, beating health workers there, arresting them in front of patients. And this increases the suffering for the civilians in conflict to incredible extent. And so much of these consequences could really be prevented if only healthcare would be properly protected in conflict. And that's such an important topic the international community needs to address more seriously.
And can you speak, Christina, about where these attacks are most prevalent, and also whether these attacks are mostly deliberate?
So our report for last year identified Ukraine and Myanmar as two countries where the whole health system is under an incredible attack. In Ukraine, some 11% of the health infrastructure has been damaged. And in Myanmar, the devastation is in so many areas through so many different ways, from arresting health workers, from the coup government bombing its own civilians. It is really, really close to unimaginable for people who live in more secure places, the extent of the violence that occurs. And these are the two countries where most events have been documented. But in total, we covered 42 countries, and it is so widespread and such a common problem in conflict.
Christina Villa, if you could talk about the best practices, though it's horrible to think in, you know, conflict regions, what are the best rules of war, but also the effect on healthcare workers specifically, and use specific examples.
I mean, there is a law of war, and that is very clear that healthcare should be protected and healthcare needs to be provided to all sides in conflict. And this is really something that the humanitarian community tries to do, to not ask who the person who needs care is, but to offer it to everyone. But the real problem is that in conflicts like Sudan, but so many others, it is the conflict parties that do not respect these rules, and that they go on deliberate attacks on the health systems in many places, and also the health workers, because they're just so important in preventing further consequences to civilians. And it is so there are practical things that humanitarian agencies can and are doing, but one of the big concerns is that there's just no impunity for this. So we have these laws, but there's never any consequences. And there, unfortunately, we have very few examples of any attempts being made to actually address that these rules of law are just not respected.
Christina Villa, very quickly before we wrap up, you've said that Russia's attacks on Ukraine are not without precedent. They're just different in terms of scale and intensity. The World Health Organization also found earlier this year that the number of attacks on healthcare facilities and personnel in Ukraine was the highest ever recorded in any humanitarian crisis. So what do you mean when you say they're not without precedent?
We've seen it in Syria, hospitals being deliberately bombed. We've seen it as far back as in Chechnya in 1996, when Russian forces attacked an ICRC-run hospital. So it definitely is nothing, unfortunately, nothing new. But we're also seeing it in many other countries. And it may also be worth to note that the Wagner forces in Africa have also been attacking health systems in the Central African Republic, for example.
Christina Villa, I want to thank you for being with us, Director of Insecurity Insight. We'll link to your new report, Ignoring Red Lines, Violence Against Healthcare in Conflict. And Dr. Khidir Dalouk, Advocacy Director of the Sudanese American Physicians Association, speaking to us from Houston. Coming up, as Russia transfers tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus, we'll speak to Professor Gilbert Achkar, author of The New Cold War, The United States, Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine. Stay with us.
And that's when he said, I don't want to be washed up without you, evolved to a lump in a shell, looking out at the world with no legs, no hands, no head, no glands, no plans, no throat, just sand. She said, well, don't go backwards, don't stay sat down too long, don't be background sound drowned out, don't get stuck, move on, don't get caught, found out, don't get lost, don't get crossed out, don't get squashed, don't come back. Don't leave. Don't get drum tracks, don't get reverb. I get you, but you don't get me. He said, I never seen more than I see right now. But we've never known less. We've never known trust, no wisdom. How can a million blips with their silicone chips and an Instagram twitch repair the deep cracks to the kingdom? She said, we're defined by our ill-formed opinions. Refreshed by the shock of it all. How novel.
Geronimo Blues by Speaker's Corner Quartet. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We turn now to Ukraine and what our next guest calls the new Cold War. The president of Belarus has announced Russia has begun transferring tactical nuclear weapons to the former Soviet state, which shares a nearly 700-mile border with Ukraine. In an interview, Belarus President Alexander Lukashenko warned he's ready to use the nuclear weapons if Belarus faces aggression. Meanwhile, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has urged allies to dig deep to provide more arms and ammunition to help Ukraine as it launches its counteroffensive against Russia. Austin's comment comes 2 days after Russian President Vladimir Putin admitted Russia is facing a shortage of ammunition, drones, and warplanes, despite a sharp increase in military production. In other news from Ukraine, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, is back in Ukraine to visit the Russia-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the largest nuclear plant in Europe. The IAEA has expressed concern the recent destruction of the Kakhovka Dam could impact the plant's supply of water needed for cooling. This all comes as the U.S. State Department has announced Tony Blinken's plan to leave Friday for a trip to China this weekend, the first by U.S. Secretary of State since 2018. In February, China put forward a 12-point peace plan to end the war in Ukraine. We're joined now by Joubert Achkar, Professor of International Relations at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. His most recent book is titled The New Cold War, The United States, Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine. He recently wrote an article for Truthout headlined, Washington is obstructing the path to a political settlement in Ukraine. And his recent Le Monde piece is headlined, A Cold War by Any Other Name. There's been much debate over the definition of the term Cold War, but one thing's for sure, we're in one now. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Professor Achkar. If you can start off with that issue that's on the table right now, this 12-point Chinese peace plan. Talk about how the U.S. media and the U.S. government characterized it. Talk about what you feel is being missed.
Yes. Well, first of all, good morning, Amy, and thank you to you and to Nermeen for inviting me. It's very important to get this opportunity, especially for a book like this one, which is of the kind that the mainstream prefers to ignore, as you know well. Now, about the Chinese plan, well, that is part of an attitude that has been expressed by China actually since the beginning of the Russian invasion in February last year. From the very beginning, I mean, 2 days into the invasion, China stated that it stands for the territorial integrity of all countries, including Ukraine. That was specified in this way. And yet that was completely ignored and shunned by Washington. And the same story happens now, because this plan is an attempt by China to set principles, general principles, and they include territorial integrity and sovereignty of all countries. So that's a very important principle to start with in addressing the issue of Ukraine. And yet that has been shunned and denounced as a sham, as empty, and all that. So there is deliberately no will on the side of Washington to get China into that, and yet there can't be any political settlement of this without involving China, and I would say also without involving the United Nations, where China, of course, is one of the five permanent members of the Security Council.
You say even Zelensky acknowledged what China was putting forward, and that while the United States says this is clearly a pro-Russia plan, that even Putin bristled at this point of China acknowledging the sovereignty of Ukraine.
Right. I mean, there was an amazing contrast between U.S. President Joe Biden speaking of the Chinese plan in very contemptuous terms, and the Ukrainian president himself, who actually emphasized the fact that this is a positive and a good starting point. And there have been, therefore, since this plan, increased negotiations and discussions between the Ukraine government and the Chinese government. So again, this is a matter of attitudes, and I think that it is very deliberate on the side of Washington. That's part of what I call the new Cold War, which hasn't started now. Desire to keep China out, to keep the United States in control of everything. I mean, this is really, and it doesn't take Beijing or Moscow to acknowledge or to see it. I mean, there is indeed, a very clear U.S. Hegemonic position, and that has been the case since the 90s.
So, Gilbert Achecard, if you could, let's go to your book and the title, The New Cold War. If you could explain what the features of the war are, who you think the principal adversaries are, and why you believe that this situation is more comparable to the global configurations of power prior to World War I, rather than that which existed between 1945 and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, which is, of course, what was termed the Cold War.
Right. Well, actually, the expression Cold War existed before the First World War. And the first use, on the record of that expression is by the German socialist leader, Edward Bernstein. And by that expression, he meant the fact that Germany was engaged in a military buildup in preparation of war against the France and the rest of its European rivals, without yet getting into a real war, into a hot war. And that's what he called a Cold War. That's the origin, actually, or the first use of the expression. And the particularity of the Cold War of post-1945, the one that is considered by historians to run from 1945 after the Second World War until 1990-91, Cold War had also an ideological dimension. But the ideological dimension is not what is called the Cold War. The Cold War refers to the military buildup and the fact that the United States, in particular, for the first time in its history, kept, even without war, a high level of military expenditure, a very high level of military expenditure, much higher than what you had between the two world wars, let alone what existed before the First World War. And that's what some American economists call the permanent war economy. Right, and that is a key characteristic of the Cold War, whether the 1945-1991 or the new Cold War that actually started after the demise of the Soviet Union, started first by Washington. Washington maintained a military budget based on the scenario of two major wars, and that was. Clearly, I explained that at the time in articles, two articles which are reproduced in the book. They make two chapters out of five, in which I said in the 90s, I showed how the military planning of the Pentagon was based on the possibility of war with both Russia and China. And that was there. And this, will lead on the background of other provocative attitudes by Washington towards these two countries into what I call the new Cold War, which I identified as starting with the Kosovo War due to the fact that this was the first time NATO as such enters into a war and a war circumventing the United Nations Security Council.
And Gilbert Achecard, so if you could speak about that, what the involvement of NATO was in Kosovo, because the first, in fact, airstrikes that NATO carried out in its history were in Bosnia against Bosnian Serbs to prevent the ethnic cleansing of Bosnian Muslims that was underway then. What distinguished the two air wars from Kosovo from those in Bosnia?
Right. I mean, the bombings since the early 90s, the bombings in former Yugoslavia remained relatively limited and were linked to the United Nations intervention in that area. But the Kosovo War is the first real war. I mean, that's what you can call a war for NATO. I mean, of course, you had a war in Bosnia, you had a war in former Yugoslavia. But NATO, the first real NATO war is the Kosovo War. And that war was conducted by circumventing the opposition of both Moscow and Beijing at the UN Security Council. So that set a pattern of ignoring, if you want, the international law and the United Nations that the two other countries found extremely alarming. And of course, that will be repeated at a much higher scale later on with the invasion of Iraq in 2003, which again was completely illegal by the standards of international law and again, of course, circumvented the Security Council.
Professor Ashkar, in an article published earlier this year headlined Consistent Anti-Imperialism and the Ukraine War, you wrote, quote, consistent anti-imperialists must combine their support of Ukraine's right to self-defense with support for a UN-based peaceful settlement on the ongoing war. Those who call for peace while opposing Ukraine's right to get what it needs for its defense are, in fact, advocating its capitulation. Can you talk about this, Ben? Also, talk about the increasing role of China here and also in other places and how the U.S. is continually trying to counter that and the significance of Blinken going to China this weekend.
Right. Well, I think there are two pitfalls that progressive forces should be avoiding. One is to react to Washington and NATO's support to Ukraine by rejecting this and ignoring in this way the agency, if you want, of the Ukrainians who are fighting for their country, they are fighting for their population, and we can see Russia is targeting more and more the civilians in Ukraine. Ukraine has the very legitimate right to self-defense, and therefore, if we acknowledge this right to self-defense, we have to acknowledge its right to get weapons for this self-defense. But this being said, I would put the emphasis on self-defense. That is, I think it is right that Ukraine gets weapons for defensive weapons like anti-aircraft, anti-missile, anti-tank, and the rest. But the demands that of escalation of the war, of enabling Ukraine to strike deep into Russian territory, and the rest, these are extremely dangerous. They put the world at very high risk. And I would say they put also the Ukrainian population at very high risk because Russia has not yet done to Ukraine what it could do if it wanted to turn even more violent than what it is. Now, on the other hand, as progressive, we have to be in favor of a peaceful settlement, a political settlement, but on the basis of principles. And I think there can't be any sustainable peace for Ukraine without the involvement of the United Nations. And without basing that peace on the principles of the UN Charter, including, of course, the sovereignty and integrity, the territorial integrity of all countries. And that would mean also, therefore, involving China. And China is obviously the country with the highest leverage over Russia, even much more now, because Russia has, because of that war, turn more and more dependent in some way economically and the rest on China. So it is imperative to associate China, to work with China, and in order to get to some peace. And, you know, even European countries like France, like Germany, major allies of the United States, advocate the involvement of China in a political settlement process, whereas Washington until now has been blocking this, probably also waiting to see what the counteroffensive, the ongoing Ukrainian counteroffensive, might produce. Now, you mentioned in the news that Antony Blinken is going to Beijing for the first time since 2018. Imagine that. That's amazing. Well, I hope then that that Washington will change its attitude and try to work with China for a political settlement of this terrible tragedy.
Gilbert Achecard, before we conclude, I'd like you to explain the longer view, historical context of what you think propelled the Russian invasion of Ukraine at this moment. You speak about the neoliberal policies, for example, that were implemented immediately after the dissolution of the Soviet Union and how that may have contributed to the rise of Putin himself. And the distinction between the causes of the Russian invasion in 2014 and 2022, why you see those as distinct?
Right. Well, first, yes. I mean, Putin himself, and I would say even Xi Jinping for China, they are in part the product of the kind of international conditions that have been created by Washington. I mean, Washington in the 90s had a window of opportunity during which, as it acknowledged itself, it was in a position to shape the world. And therefore, it faced several options. And, well, instead of going for options, peaceful options, options leading to a long-term peace in international relations and into enhancing the role of the United Nations, it made the opposite choices. One of them being, of course, the choice of not only keeping NATO, which was originally built as a defensive alliance against the Soviet Union, but to enlarge NATO eastward towards countries that were previously under Soviet domination. You mentioned, yes, the neoliberal policies that were promoted and fostered in Russia by Washington, by the International Monetary Fund and the whole set of Western interests. And they were absolutely destructive of Russian society. I mean, the 90s are nightmarish for if you look at what happened at the very sharp drop in the standard of living of the Russians, to the point that in the late 90s, the gross domestic product, that is the whole economy of Russia, was equal to only the military budget of the United States. That tells you a lot, right? So this is the creation that created, I mean, the condition, the situation that created Vladimir Putin, I mean, his kind of nationalist authoritarian rule. And of course, even that rule itself has an evolution over the years, which went further and further into nationalism and authoritarianism, but that was on a background of conflicting relations with Washington, with the Western countries, with NATO. And played a real role in that regard. And in the same way, as I just said, that also the kind of provocative attitude of the United States towards China created conditions under which nationalism can flourish and lead also to a increased authoritarianism and nationalism as represented by China's present ruler, Xi Jinping. So there is a connection between all that because the global conditions, well, create a terrain for this or that, depending on their nature, this or that development. So, yes, you had this. Now,
we just have a minute to go, Professor Achecard.
Excuse me?
We just have a minute to go, Professor Achecard.
Oh, right. Well, very quickly, the two wars, the two military interventions by Russia in Georgia in 2008 and in Ukraine 2014 were meant by the Russian side to block the accession of these two countries to NATO by creating a war-like situation with the two countries. We can't say the same of the annexation of Crimea, which also took part, took place in 2014, which was meant by Vladimir Putin as a means to restore his popularity, which had been dwindling beforehand. He knew how this could play very well with Russian nationalism. And the 2022 invasion, indeed, is plainly in that context. It wasn't to block Ukraine's accession to NATO, because that wasn't on the table anyway at that point.
Zubair Ashkar, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Professor of International Relations at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. His most recent book, just out, The New Cold War, The United States, Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine. And we'll link to your most recent piece, Washington's Obstructing the Path to a Political Settlement in Ukraine. Coming up, we go to Johannesburg, South Africa. Why was Kumi Naidu, the former head of Amnesty International, as well as Greenpeace, thrown out of a bank meeting? Stay with us.
Soldiers who want to be heroes number practically zero, but there are millions who want to be civilians. Soldiers who want to be heroes number practically zero, but there are millions who want to be civilians. Come and take my eldest son, show him how to shoot a gun, wipe his eyes if he starts to cry when the bullets fly. Give him a rifle, take his hoe, show him a field where he can go.
Soldiers Who Want to Be Heroes by The Specials. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We end today's show in South Africa, where climate campaigners attempted to disrupt the annual shareholders meeting for Standard Bank to protest the bank's financing of the proposed East African crude oil pipeline, known as ECOP. The 900-mile pipeline would carry crude oil from Uganda to Tanzania. France's Total Energies and the China National Offshore Oil Corporation are behind ECOP, working with Ugandan and Tanzanian state-owned oil firms. Kumi Naidu, former head of Greenpeace and Amnesty International, and Extinction Rebellion activist Malik Dassou, were forcibly removed from Standard Bank during their peaceful protest. Kumi Naidu joins us now from Johannesburg, South Africa. Kumi, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain your protest and explain exactly for a global audience what ECOP is.
So basically, Standard Bank, like many other banks around the world, on the one hand now recognize that we are in a climate emergency, recognize that there must change, but their actions appear to be contradictory when it comes to an increase in fossil fuel investments that we are seeing, as was the case with Standard Bank. In particular, the East African crude oil pipeline project will see about 100,000 Tanzanians and Ugandans displaced. We've already seen the signs of human rights violations. Of course, as always, they will promise that there's going to be massive numbers of jobs. We know most of the jobs are transient. Most of the early jobs, in fact, at the higher paid level, will be people from outside of community. The bottom line, though, is that this East African crude oil pipeline is a carbon bomb. The amount of carbon that this would put into the atmosphere will be catastrophic, right? That would be the equivalent of sort of 9 million cars, for example, on the road. And so in addition to that, Standard Bank is also supporting the Cabo Delgado oil gas projects in Mozambique. And here in South Africa, in KwaZulu-Natal, they have been supporting Tendele Coal, a project that has seen activists being killed and so on. And essentially what we are saying to Standard Bank and to other banks, that you need to recognize that you are now legitimate targets of protests, that we do not have time right now to go after every oil, coal, gas company, every deforestation company, and so on. We have to follow the money and shut the flow of capital at source. And basically, this might have been aimed specifically at Standard Bank, but it is also a call and an encouragement to activists all over the world. Let's follow the money and let's shut the flow of capital to dirty energy and start redirecting it to clean energy.
And Kumi Naidoo, so could you explain who are, what are the companies that are backing this pipeline, the Chinese corporation, the National Offshore Oil Corporation, as well as Total Energies, the French company?
Well, Total is the biggest play in all of this. And here's the kicker, right? Assuming that this was okay in environmental terms, right? Let's just for a moment say all our concerns are misplaced, right? But all of this is nothing's going to Africa. All of this is going to Europe, okay? So it's extraction at its worst. It's colonial. It's going to potentially put the investors in this project, like other investors that are putting money into carbon bombs right now. The threat that they must understand is that activism against that is rising all around the world, and the possibility of them ending up with what they like to call stranded carbon assets is becoming more and more a reality.
Just oil, the wealth of natural resources across the continent of Africa, why so many of them, and certainly the profits, are going to Europe, to China and elsewhere, but not to the continent itself?
I think we've lost each other.
Can you hear us, Kumi? Can you hear us, Kumi?
I don't hear them anymore.
We're talking to Kumi Naidoo in Johannesburg, South Africa. He may have just lost the line to us. He's the former head of Greenpeace International and also Amnesty International. And he was just thrown out of a Standard Bank meeting in South Africa protesting ECOP. Let me go to Extinction Rebellion activist Malik Dasu, who was also thrown out with Kumi, speaking outside Standard Bank's AGM.
We want them to invest in renewable energy for the mass populations, vulnerable communities, directed where it's needed. The concept of energy justice should be the primary guiding principle that informs all their investment strategies in energy from now on.
Germany also held Stop ECOP protests in Bonn, where they gathered for a COP28 prep conference. This year's United Nations-sponsored climate summit will be hosted by one of the world's biggest fossil fuel producers, the United Arab Emirates. The meeting will be presided over by the head of UAE's national oil company, Sultan Al Jaber. On Tuesday, the Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, who recently graduated from high school, spoke at the conference.
It is what we decide now that will define the rest of humanity's future. And whether we choose to do that or not, if we don't, it will be a death sentence to countless of people. And it is already a death sentence to countless of people living on the front lines of the climate crisis today.
On Tuesday, the U.S. Special Climate Envoy, John Kerry, told the U.N. Security Council global steps to tackle climate change must be ramped up and the world needs to more aggressively reduce its reliance on coal and other fossil fuels.
It's now indisputable that the climate crisis is one of the top security threats, not just to the developed world, but to the entire planet, to life on the planet itself. And it is a crisis that already today costs countries billions of dollars each year, which we spend not even to prevent at this point, but just to clean up the mess. And most importantly, it costs the world millions of lives. It's an active threat against the livelihoods and the peace of people everywhere on this planet.
In May, over 130 U.S. lawmakers and members of the European Parliament sent a joint letter to President Biden, to the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, as well as the U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres, demanding the removal of Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber, head of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, as president of the upcoming U.N. Climate Summit, COP28, in the UAE. The lawmakers include Senators Ed Markey and Bernie Sanders, who wrote, "One of the largest barriers to strong climate action has been and remains the political influence and obstruction of the fossil fuel industry and other major polluting industries." We want to thank Kumi Naidu in Johannesburg, South Africa, the former head of Greenpeace International and Amnesty International, who just got detained along with Extinction Rebellion thrown out of a Standard Bank meeting. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Fels, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
WRCD Pittsburgh.
You forgot to say who you are and with what band.
Yeah, I know. Hello, this is Reza from Le Vent du Nord. You're listening to WRCD Pittsburgh.
Everybody ready?
It's time for Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio. I am Amanda Richard. Thanks so much for tuning in to Whiskey Before Breakfast or The Roots Program, depending on where you are located. I've got a great show lined up for you. We'll start off on the liquored up side of the family. We'll end up on the gospel side of the family, like we always do. And in between, we've got some great music, old and new. We'll hear from a young lady named Stella Prince at the start of the second hour. Now, we've got lots of stuff, including Woody Snyder. But let's get things started right away. Here come Flattened Scruggs of the Foggy Mountain Boys doing Hot Corn, Cold Corn.
Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a Dame John. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a Dame John. Farewell, Uncle Bill, see you in the morning. Yes, sir. Well, it's upstairs, downstairs, out in the kitchen. Upstairs, downstairs, out in the kitchen. Upstairs, downstairs, out in the kitchen. See Uncle Bill just a-running and a-pitching. Yes, sir. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a Dame John. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a Dame John. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a Dame John. Farewell, Uncle Bill, see you in the morning. Yes, sir. Thank you. Well, it's old Aunt Peggy, won't you fill them up again? Old Aunt Peggy, won't you fill them up again? Old Aunt Peggy, won't you fill them up again? Ain't had a drink since I don't know when. Yes, sir.
Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a demijohn. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a demijohn. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a demijohn. Farewell, Uncle Bill, see you in the morning. Yes, sir.
Well, yonder comes a preacher and the children are crying. Yonder comes a preacher and the children are crying. Yonder comes a preacher and the children are crying. Chickens all are running and the toenails are flying. Yes, sir.
Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a demijohn. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a demijohn. Hot corn, cold corn, bring along a demijohn. Farewell, Uncle Bill, see you in the morning. Yes, sir.